Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello there from Bolivia. How are you all? Did you all have a good weekend? I've got a couple of days here now after spending a few days at the BitConf in Uruguay. Really fascinating place, actually. I'm doing a show here for Defiance, so can't wait to get that all out for you. Anyway, welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got an interview with Nathaniel Rich, who recently wrote an article for Vanity Fair regarding Quadriga CX and the suspicious circumstances surrounding the death of its CEO, Gerald Cotton. But before that, I've got a message from my amazing sponsors. So first up today, we have Wire. And I do want to thank everyone who's checked them out. We have a few shows left this month before the end of the Wire sponsorship. So if you haven't checked them out, please do. Let's give them a final boost before their sponsorship ends. So Wire helping companies across the space offer Bitcoin onboarding. So whether you are a solo developer or a large team, if you are looking to simplify user onboarding and offer your users a fast and easy way to purchase Bitcoin, then you really need to talk to Wire. They've been killing it since 2013, and they focus on taking care of all the heavy lifting in terms of compliance, payments, and liquidity, so you can focus on building your core offering. Your idea could be the next killer app, so do not let the regulators kill it. To find out more, reach out to Wire or create a developer account at sendwire.com, which is S-E-N-D-W-Y-R-E.com. And next up, we have Dropbit, my favorite mobile wallet. You know how much I love these. I have been waxing lyrical about them all year, and they have absolutely crushed in 2019. So come on, have you downloaded the app yet? Have you checked it out? They have recently announced the launch of Lightning in the app, and they've also opened it up for everyone. So you don't need to get unlocked. Everyone with Dropbit gets Lightning now. They also support BETCH32 addresses, and you can now onboard directly in the app. Yes, you can buy Bitcoin directly in the Dropbit app. On top of that, you can tweet Bitcoin, you can text Bitcoin. You can do so much with the Dropbit app. If you haven't tried it out, you need to check it out. Come on, the year's nearly over. It's available for the iPhone and Android. Just head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. And I also need to welcome my new sponsor, Scott Offord, and his company, Crypto Mining Tools. So Scott is a crypto mining consultant, and I want you to check out his Bitcoin mining calculator. It's available at cryptomining.tools. You can enter your estimated uptime to get more realistic profit projections. It also includes the impact of the Bitcoin block reward halving, which is coming next year, which we are all very excited about. If you're wondering which miner is the most efficient or has the best chance of breaking even, you should try out their new interactive hardware comparison chart as well. As an ASIC mining equipment broker, Scott helps you make data-backed decisions. He can help you find hosting, raw power, and land to get your miners up and hashing. If you want to find out more, you can reach out to Scott on Telegram or Twitter at OfforedScott, which is OfforedScott, or visit cryptomining.tools, which is CrypToMining.tools. Okay, so onto the show today, and I have Nathaniel Rich, who recently wrote an article for Vanity Fair about the death of Gerald Cotton and Quadriga CX. As most of you know, Quadriga was a Canadian exchange that earlier this year ceased operations. What you might not know is the situation around this, and it's pretty weird, pretty fucked up. Some real crazy shit goes on with this story. The CEO of Quadriga was this guy named Gerald Cotton, and in December 2018, he went on his honeymoon in India with his new wife, and while on that trip, he got sick and died from complications around Crohn's disease. It came to light that Gerald was the only person with access to the exchange cold storage private keys, which held a reported $250 million in customer funds. Now, there's been a whole bunch of conspiracy theories flying around with this. There's a lot of people doing their own private research, a lot of topics discussed on Reddit. Some claimed he faked his own death to exit scam with the funds, or that after losing some ether in a smart contract, Gerald had tried a margin trade his way out of the hole using customer funds and ended up losing the lot. Others said he was working with criminal enterprises, harboring money for them and using the exchange to, you know, hold and launder those funds. And after losing their funds, he faked his death to avoid any kind of repercussions from that. So it's a very complicated story, and it's one we may never get to the bottom of. what actually happened. But in this interview, Nathaniel and I do a bit of a deep dive into the events, and I get Nathaniel's opinion on what he thinks really happened. And also, since I recorded this interview, it's just been announced that the lawyers representing the customers of Quadriga have requested for Gerald's body to be exhumed because they want to kind of like prove he actually did die. So yes, a weird and fascinating story. But anyway, I hope you enjoy it. If you've got any feedback, you can hit me up on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Just a note that I'm out in Bolivia right now. I'm working on a piece regarding the political unrest here for Defiance. It's a very interesting story, so I can't wait to get that out. I'm hoping to head to El Salvador after this. I've got a couple of potential interviews lined up there, and then I'm going to be heading into the States for a few days before I head back home to Christmas. It's been an amazing year. Thank you for all your support. If you do have any questions, do reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it. And it's been, you know, I had no idea how the Bitcoin community, for lack of a better term, would respond to the piece. So it's been exciting to see, you know, my sense of it is that there's been a lot of enthusiasm. And so that's been good. Of course, my biggest fear was getting some very basic technological aspect wrong.
Yeah, don't worry about that. I just did one with Jamie Bartlett. He's from the BBC. He did a podcast series called The Missing Crypto Queen about the one
coin. Oh, yeah, that sounds great. I haven't listened to it yet, but it sounds fascinating.
I mean, it is really, really good. He did a great job with it, and I interviewed him. And, you know, he doesn't have a Bitcoin background, but he could kind of get a good sense for Bitcoin and the technicals and kind of what is a scam and what isn't. But I found your story. I read it in full, and I'm not one for usually reading long form pieces. I'm more of an audio person, but I've read it through twice now, and I found it very interesting because I'm aware of the story. Yeah, obviously aware of the story, but I've not done a deep dive in it. The closest I've got is actually reading your article. So there was a lot I didn't know until I read yours, but still, with what I knew about the story, I couldn't help but thinking, this is a very convenient death.
You mean even before you read? Yeah. Well, I think that was the assumption that a lot of people, certainly within the Bitcoin world, made right away. And you know, what I did find in my reporting, speaking with people, many of whom are totally legit and have very virtuous reasons for working in the industry or investing, there is a level of secrecy that approaches, and paranoia that almost approached fetishization, I found, which was at some points amusing and at other points frustrating when I was just trying to ask somebody for basic information, and I'd have to go through a whole kind of protocol of, you know, earning trust and all. And of course, I understand how that connects to the ideology. Of course, it draws people who have these concerns and is predicated on not trusting strangers and all of that, but it was almost cartoonish at points. And so, but I think it was natural for people in this world to question the official narrative. And so right away you had folks, not only creditors, but just people in this realm instantly jumping to the conclusion that no, he can't actually have died. There must be something more to the story.
Well, I think a lot of people in Bitcoin are very cynical. You know, there's been so many incidents of thefts or hacks or exit scams that instantly when something like this happens, you are very suspicious. And there is like a Mt. Gox PTSD, which stays with everyone. So I did a series on Mt. Gox. I interviewed Jed McCallum, Mark Capellas, and a few of the other players in it. And it was very interesting for me as somebody much newer to Bitcoin. I think I was a lot more understanding of Mark Karpalis's position. I just, you know, I think a lot of people looked at it with $20,000 Bitcoin eyes when it wasn't a $20,000 Bitcoin when it happened. And he just made a bunch of stupid mistakes. But there's certainly a PTSD that's there. So when something like Quadriga happens, there's kind of instant suspicion. And yeah, and I expect as you came in, you were probably a little bit more objective than the people you spoke to.
Yeah, I mean, the shocking thing for me in the reporting, sort of the turning point, I guess, as it were, was that I came into it, I thought, well, this is, you know, I actually had almost the opposite response, I guess, right early on when I first read the accounts, was not to say, oh, isn't it convenient that he's dead, but more, isn't it convenient, this sort of mastermind theory? It almost seemed too good to be true from a narrative standpoint, that this guy faked his own death and got away with it. It seemed outlandish. And so the shocking turn for me in the reporting was when I finally interviewed the lawyers at Miller Thompson, this very fancy Bay Street, Canada law firm, who represent the class of creditors. And I said, well, I have to ask you, like, you know, do you think any of this conspiracy theories you see on you know, Reddit are accurate? And they said, oh yeah. Like, not only did they think that a lot of that might be true, but it was clear that they and Ernst & Young, who was doing the investigation on behalf of the class, had even gotten a lot of their breaks from revelations they had found on Reddit. And so at that point, I realized that actually the serious investigators, the serious sleuths, were the ones who were operating these anonymous accounts online, and not the professionals at Ernst & Young or even RCMP, the Canadian FBI, basically, or the FBI itself. And that opened my eyes to a different dimension of the story. And it's what makes this story so unique, I think, in you know, the annals of contemporary crime and cons, is that the people who are most adept at investigating a case like this are not paid professionals, but the sort of amateurs, I guess, or even, you know, professional or Bitcoin professionals who are generally outside of mainstream, you know, criminal investigative communities. And so that opened up this whole realm of actually taking seriously things that I would never have dreamt of taking seriously before I started reporting the piece.
Well, so are you aware of this character Craig Wright? Claims to be Satoshi.
Yes, I've come across him. Yeah.
So actually, he's suing me right now in the High Court in the UK for calling him a fraud. But one of the most interesting things about him is whenever he puts out one of his claims, there is like an army of people who research it and debunk it at the most technical level. That it's quite astounding, to be honest. So much so, there's now a whole website dedicated to debunking at a very highly technical level his mistakes and where he's wrong. So that itself is super interesting. But I guess where I want to start with you on this, which is different from where I thought I would approach it with you, is I almost want to start with the conclusions and work back. The reason being is, after reading your article, I had a slightly different view than I originally came in. But the first question I want to ask you is, has anybody seen a body?
No. There was no autopsy requested in India. The widow, Jennifer Robertson, did not request one, which she's entitled to do, although you could certainly defend her decision, assuming he actually died. The body then is flown back with her to Canada. There is a funeral at a funeral parlor in Halifax, and it's a closed casket. And then he's interred. And the only investigative body that can disinter it is the RCMP. And to this point, they have declined to do so or shown no interest in doing so. But what I have heard from my sources who have been interviewed by both the RCMP and the FBI, which has its own, I think, fairly considerably more robust investigation, it would seem, is that the FBI, because nobody's seen the body, is not taking it for granted that he's dead.
So he was buried, not cremated?
Yes, there was originally a rumor that he was cremated, but that did not, but no, he wasn't cremated.
Well, the easiest thing to do is exhume the body and check.
That is. And probably, I think there's a decent chance that might happen. I mean, if these investigations dead end somewhere, it would seem to make sense. But yes, impossible for us to know at this point.
So I'll tell you where my kind of switch came with the article, is that originally I was kind of on the fence, in that there were the suggestions it was an exit scam, $250 million. And whilst totally believable, because many things like that have happened in the world of Bitcoin, I didn't 100% buy it, because I was like, well, you know, if he is really exit scammed, how's he really going to live a life, you know, on the run and move these coins without anyone knowing and seeing, you know, someone will come after him. So I was kind of on the fence. I had some doubts about whether he really had died. But at the same time, I thought, well, I'm probably just being a cynical Bitcoiner. But then I read the article and realized that he'd most likely lost all the money. And then I felt like, well, actually, now there's a very good reason to do a disappearing act, because you don't have the money. And therefore, there's very little, wherever he is, if he is alive, if he has cash, there's very little paper trail to him. You know, he could assume a new identity somewhere, maybe in deepest, darkest India somewhere now, and head to a Panama, who knows? So I kind of came to the fact that the money was lost, you know, whether it's through, you know, bad investments or trading, et cetera, et cetera. It's more likely that he's alive than if the money still existed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And the way I wrote the piece, there are a couple of scenarios. There's the mastermind theory, in which it's all going to plan, essentially, and it's all planned out this way, and a deception. There's the you know, royal fuck-up theory, where he's just an incompetent scammer and everything goes wrong. And then, of course, there's the kind of virtuous Jerry theory, that he's trying to overcome his youthful, you know, 2-bit con artist games and thinks he can go straight with this exchange. And so what you're proposing is essentially a combination of those first two, that there's a fuck up who then masterminds his own disappearance. And it is something I considered. I thought one of the probably the best argument for that, or the best motivation for that narrative, would be if he lost a bunch of money that was possessed by some powerful, dangerous people. And so that would really be, you know, that then we get into this idea that Quadrigo was used as a money laundering operation by some very powerful, who knows, drug cartels, or again, and there's some evidence that it was. And so the idea then that he got all this money, you know, ill-begot funds, and then lost it, and then tried to trade himself, you know, tried desperately to recover it through these ridiculous trades. And then when he realized he couldn't, yeah, he went on the run, basically. I think that's possible, but I suppose I would want more evidence suggesting that he was in cahoots with some serious criminal, And I guess where you would look then is the relationship with Mike Patron and Patron's own connection in the criminal underworld and the money laundering that he was involved in various, under various guises and other and operations earlier on, particularly Midas Gold. So I think that's possible. I wouldn't rule it out. I think the hardest, the greatest challenge to the fake death scenario, regardless of the motivation for faking a death, does come down to the body and the widow. So you have to answer the question, is the widow in on it? If the widow is not in on it, then you have to then believe that she witnessed this horrific 24 or 48 hours of her husband being fatally sick and buying. And that's almost impossible to believe, that he would fake this like terrible illness where he's basically shitting himself to death. So that I'd rule that out. And then the question is, well, if they're in on it together, why didn't she disappear as well? Why did they risk her coming back to Canada, having to deal with the lawsuits and the lawyers and the real estate and all the rest?
Yeah. And add to that, if there is criminal dark forces at play, you add significant risk to her. You know, if there are dark forces who've lost money, they might do anything to leverage her to say, where is he? Is he alive? That seems quite risky. And I also think if she was in on it, one of the most sensible things to do would be to cremate the body.
Yeah, well, one of the most sensible things to do would be to say, oh, they fell off a cliff, or they were in a car crash, or they're in some kind of, you know, double death situation, rather than to say he had Crohn's disease, died from complications of Crohn's disease, and she then has to play the part of the mourning widow for years, presumably. So, you know, I think that's that's the best counter argument, is sort of the difficulty of that fake death scheme. But certainly there are plenty of people who think that that is exactly what happened. And in fact, you know, the FBI and these other federal investigative organizations are not ruling it out.
Do you have a gut feel yourself?
My gut feeling is that he was probably, I mean, I sort of what I write in the piece, that is the most likely scenario is that he was a con artist who got in way over his head and fucked up and got desperate and panicky, made some terrible decisions that were informed in part by an inflated ego, given the success he'd had, and died in India. But that doesn't mean that the other thing, you know, I think where I come down, and I've seen other people sort of in this, in the quadriga sphere, come down this way, is that it's something like a 70 or 80% he's dead, but a pretty, you know, impressive 20 to 30% chance that he's not.
Which makes it an interesting story. And if they were ever to exhume the body and he wasn't there, or it wasn't him.
I should say, when I started reporting the piece, I was at 99, you know, 0.5, and that he was dead. So it was through the reporting, I became less certain, which was the biggest surprise to me.
Well, that's always the case with these really interesting cases. It doesn't matter whether it's crypto, you know, or something else. When there's like, when you get into these stories where there's so many different like facets of information that leave you with a little bit of doubt about what actually happened, these mysteries, you know, whether it's this, whether it's something like the disappearance of Madeleine McCann or something, whenever there's these stories that have so many different interesting players and characters that you're just like, it's kind of frustrating not to even know. Like, having the mystery is kind of a bit fucking frustrating. Okay, well, I'm kind of, I guess I'd probably say that's a fair balance, like the 70-30, 80-20.
I mean, I think what makes the story, what makes it so interesting, though, is not only the whodunit aspect of it, but I think it raises some larger issues about not just, you know, cryptocurrency, but the way that we, you know, how we put faith in institutions, or even those of us who are most jaded about putting faith in institutions, nevertheless, you know, trick themselves into thinking that this quadriga exchange was trustworthy. And it does seem to touch on a sort of greater human frailty, that even those, you know, even those who are most cynical, most on guard, who have invested their lives in this new kind of currency that is essentially designed to avoid falling into these traps, these social traps, still are not immune from a cheap 2-bit con man.
Well, so most Bitcoiners would turn around and say they're morons, because, you know, there's a couple of terms that are kind of key and repeated regularly. The first one is don't trust verify. You know, that's, you know, Bitcoin is trustless, so you shouldn't trust anyone. But the other thing is, there's this saying, I don't know if you came across it, but not your keys, not your Bitcoin, which is the idea that if you don't have the private keys, it's not your Bitcoin. So there's a very leading person in Bitcoin called Trace Mayer, who last year on the 3rd of January, the anniversary of the Bitcoin protocol, like the 10-year anniversary, ran a program whereby he wanted people to go to exchanges and take all their Bitcoin off, because you should not be trusting an exchange. And by that, you know, it did two things. Firstly, it forced people to own their private keys and manage their Bitcoin. But secondly, it forced us to see if we can trust these exchanges. There's also people who've been pushing for exchanges to provide verifiable proof that they hold the funds that they say they do. But I think that's actually, I don't think that's the best option. But so many people obviously trusted this exchange. And also, interestingly, following your article, he managed to build up a lot of trust in himself, turning up at events, donating lots of money. It's typical, you could say it's almost sociopathic behavior. And I ended up thinking, he's kind of the crypto Bernie Madoff. That's what I've got written down here. It feels like it became a Ponzi.
Yeah, I wouldn't qualify it. I think it's straight up sociopathic.
Okay.
Even before the exit or whatever happened at the end, I mean, he was... the level of recklessness with which he was running the exchange, even if his ultimate goals were virtuous, I mean, he wasn't keeping any records. So there's a total disregard of you know, any kind of concern of protecting his clients' funds. But you're right. I mean, with the exchanges are this funny loophole in the Bitcoin world where it's a workaround. It's a black box, and you don't know what happens inside of it. And it's not on what goes on in the exchange. It's not on the blockchain. And so it was shocking to me once I learned that. I didn't understand that when I had started reporting. But once I realized, oh, this is like just this black box where you throw your money and then you hope that you get it out. I mean, it totally subverts the basic ideals and even, you know, methodology of cryptocurrency. And yet, look, a lot of people, you know, a lot of grandmothers and you know, uncles and lost money on this exchange, but also a lot of, you know, serious crypto professionals in Canada lost a lot of money. So there was an element of social engineering, and some of the sources I interviewed and quoted in the piece said as much. Even those who knew that the business partner, Mike Patrin, had a really shady past, they thought, well, Jerry seems legit. So even though it's an exchange, and even though it's connected to this other guy, I'm still going to invest in it. And of course, they feel foolish now, and they understand intellectually why you should never keep money on exchanges. But that didn't stop them or enough of them from doing it anyway.
Yeah, and it's a real shame. You know what? It will happen again. And this is a sad thing. It's, you know, I don't keep anything on an exchange. I understand why some people do from a lack of experience, but it almost feels like some of the exchanges, even though it's probably not within their interest, should be encouraging people not to keep things on exchanges. Okay, so what would be very useful for people listening to this is for you to explain the scale of the mismanagement of the money that you became aware of, because that was fascinating. Because the reason I ask is it's a company holding $250 million in funds. You would assume a very professional operation with very professional security practices. And it felt like a small business operating out of a garage with no real processes.
Yeah, it was worse than that. It was a single, you know, 20-something-year-old on his laptop. He didn't even have the garage. I mean, he had an office at one point, but it, you know, as I write in the piece, it basically looked like a front. There were just a few desks and nothing was really going on in there. It was all on his laptop. So, I mean, to answer your question, there was no accounting. I mean, so one of the more comical aspects of this piece is that you have Ernst & Young, which is one of the major, you know, the big four accounting firms in the world, who come in and become the monitor. They essentially represent. Their job is to claw back as much of the funds as possible for the creditors, who the 75,000 plus people who lost money on the exchange, and they get access to the you know, Quadriga computers and the internal website, and the level of sort of shock and disdain you imagine them you can see it in their very very sober technical report, where they basically say, informal language, we can't believe what the fuck we're seeing. Like there's absolutely no accounting. There's no sense of, you know, where the money's coming in, where it's coming out. He was responding basically on an ad hoc basis to individuals as they asked to withdraw money from their account. At the end, when it got so crazy, it seemed that he was prioritizing account holders who were making the biggest noise on social media. So anybody who posts on Reddit and it's like, what the fuck is going on with Quadriga? We need to, I've had, you know, $3,000 I've been trying to get out for 3 months. Boom, the next day, Jerry would send him his money. But if you were just quietly frustrated, it took much longer. And so there weren't any internal controls. There weren't even other employees. He had some contractors who were trying to keep up, but they were way behind, and they would just get these. It all functioned through this process of tickets, which were essentially complaints. So if somebody couldn't get their money out, they would file a ticket, a complaint, and say, you know, what the problem was. And they had this backlog of, it sounds like, hundreds of complaints that they would just be working through. And it seemed like the main job of Quadriga, the main work that was being done during the last few months, was simply trying to figure out, you know, which disgruntled customer to get their money back, you know, to send their money. It's not like a bank website where you say withdraw $100 and it comes out. This was all done manually. And he was doing things in like Excel, files. It was essentially like what you would imagine a teenager to do if he was asked to run an exchange. So it was totally chaotic, and if all you knew about Quadriga was that they had no accounting whatsoever, I think the inescapable implication would be that it was a scam, that there was no real interest in actually running a professional, you know, business, but it was simply to accumulate as much money as possible before people found out what was going on.
But it doesn't sound like he did accumulate much money. It sounded like he did the opposite. And the operations of the business sound very much like, you know, somebody who's gotten themselves in financial difficulty, and they're letting the red letters for all the bills kind of pile up, and they're dealing with the one they have to most quickly. Like, if it was a scam for him to build up as much money as possible, he kind of did the opposite.
Well, the problem was because he was so incapable, not only for technical reasons, but also for legal reasons, of doing a lot of the work himself, he had to outsource a lot of it. So he outsourced, you know, web design, but he outsourced all the banking as well. And he was paying, so enormous amounts of money did start flowing in during the rise when Bitcoin started, you know, rising. But he was also spending a fortune on transaction fees to these third-party payment processors who were the intermediary between Quadriga and actual banks, to use a loophole in regulatory law in Canada. And furthermore, that opened him up to other, you know, scams against him. So a lot of these third-party payment processors who are essentially functioning as a legal workaround, maybe, I think that's a kind of business that might be more likely to not respect laws and regulations. So a lot of those companies started basically flat out stealing from Quadriga as well. So,
wow.
And then there was a technical error where they lost $14 million in an Ether bug. And so there were a bunch of cases where they lost millions of dollars at a time, whether through theft or incompetence. And at one point, a bank grew suspicious of one of these third-party payment processors and seized about $25 million. You know, so there were a lot of deficits as well. But when the market was running, there was so much volume that he was doing pretty good. You know, he's still doing pretty well and didn't really care about those losses. It was only when the market started to fall and people wanted their money back that he was in a bind.
Shit. It's fucking insane as a story. At the time they went to India, have you got any idea of the amount of funds they had actually in the business?
Yeah, so publicly, by the time he goes to India, Quadriga is in trouble. This is the end of 2018. And a lot of people are complaining about not being able to get their funds out. And his excuse at the time is this lawsuit that he's been entangled with CIBC, one of the big four Canadian banks, which I was just referring to, where they had seized something like $25 million from a third-party processor. And so he blamed the lack of funds on this seizure, but it doesn't makes, in retrospect, that doesn't quite make sense it doesn't make sense at all, because that's something like $25 million and he should have had about, you know, $250 million. So it doesn't quite add up. And what we now know is that he'd already lost a lot of the money, but it's hard to determine, well, had he lost all of the money except for that $30 million that was impounded? Had he lost $200 million? Had he lost $100 million? That's where it gets a little bit tricky. But he'd certainly squandered, I think, you know, it seems like at least more than 100 million of it by that point.
He was certainly at the point where he had an incentive to disappear. The pressure was on.
The pressure was on, and there was no apparent way out at that point.
Because the market was crashing. So add to that then, how much has been recovered?
So far, something like 30 million, which is, it's basically only the low-hanging fruit. So it's kind of the scraps that were left in the their various wallets that they found, and money from a couple of these third-party payment processors that have agreed to give the money back to Ernst & Young. You know, a lot of the funds we now know were on these other exchanges where he was, seemed to be gambling them, and most of those exchanges, it seems, are not participating with, you know, are not basically agreeing to turn over the money or to turn over their internal records of what happened to the money to investigators. That's one of the murkiest parts of it, because I do think that the FBI has been more successful there than the RCMP. And I've been told that the FBI actually does have at least some of that information of where the money went that was on these other exchanges. But that's still pretty obscure because, of course, the FBI investigation is totally under wraps. You would think that if any of those exchanges had significant amounts of money still on their exchange in these accounts that Jerry started, that they would turn it over. If they're participating, that they would have turned it over to Ernst & Young, and there's no indication that they have. So my best guess is that all the money that he put on these other exchanges was gone before his death.
And he was on these exchanges trading. He was trying to trade himself out of the position he got into, but turns out he's not a particularly good trader.
Well, that's one theory. I mean, he was certainly doing a lot of reckless trading on these other accounts. You know, there's another theory that the FBI is interested in, that the idea being that the trades were so reckless and so crazy and so exotic, you know, trading on much more obscure you know, forms of cryptocurrency, that they could have perhaps been structured in such a way that, you know, that he was losing the money to another account that he either controlled or that someone in cahoots with him controlled, and thus it was a way of laundering the money through the black box of another exchange to another person or entity. So that's possible, although it seems less. It does seem more likely that he simply started to panic because he'd already had, you know, he had lost some of the money. He was trying to earn it back by making these crazy bets, and of course that they failed, and he got even further into the hole.
Next up, I talked to Nathaniel Moore about Quadriga CX and Gerald Cotton, but before that, I got a message from my amazing sponsors. So first up, we have the mighty Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. Are you using Kraken? Why not? Come on. They've absolutely crushed this year, like every single one of my sponsors. I seem to have found the companies who innovate the most, which is super cool. If you aren't already aware, they are the most secure exchange there is. I did an interview with their chief security officer this year, Nick Pococo. That's definitely worth checking out. But even beyond the security, even beyond them preventing dirty hackers getting in and stealing your Bitcoin, which is highly relevant with the interview I'm doing today, they've got so much there for traders. Like if you're a trader, they have got everything you could possibly want. They've got Kraken.com, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. They've got margin trading with up to 5x leverage. They've got futures. They've got indices. They've got the Kraken OTC desk for large trades with private and personalized services. They've got CryptoWatch, where you can trade on multiple exchanges from a single platform. They've also just released Kraken Pro, a beautiful mobile-first app so you can trade Kraken wherever you want. They have seriously got you covered as a trader. If you want to find out more, head over to Kraken.com or download the app, which is available for the iPhone and Android. Just search for Kraken Pro, which is K-R-A-K-E-N-P-R-O. And next up, we have BlockFi, the amazing BlockFi, the future of Bitcoin and financial services. And I was hanging out with Zach and Flory out in Uruguay. We had dinner. We talked about everything that's coming next year.
fuck me, they've got some cool stuff coming. Not only have they crushed 2019, they're going to kill it next year as well. They've got some amazing things coming. I really want to tell you. God, I really want to tell you, but I can't yet. But next year, we're going to have some big announcements, some really cool stuff coming for BlockFi. And they are the best in the sector. They are building a powerhouse in Bitcoin borrowing and lending. So if you need a crypto loan, if you want to buy a new car, you want to go on a badass holiday, you want to get yourself some new clothes, you want to take a trip to the moon, or if you got to pay the man, BlockFi have got you covered. And if you want to earn interest on your Bitcoin, Ether, or GSD, well, they have dropped all minimum deposits. They have removed the early withdrawal penalty, and you can receive interest payments in the currency of your choice. I am a customer. I freaking love getting my interest every month. So if you are interested in finding out more, you've got to do your own research, then head over to blockfi.com, which is BlockFi.com. Tell me a little bit about his background, because he's had a history of being involved in very questionable projects slash scams in the past.
Yeah, he's sort of a suburban guy, well-educated, grew up in Belleville, sort of a smaller city between Montreal and Toronto, I believe. And he went to a good college, to an honors program at York Business School, undergraduate, graduated, I think, with honors, and never got a job after graduation. He right away seemed to have been involved in cryptocurrency. That was sort of the official narrative. But what I discovered in the reporting was, in fact, beginning in high school, probably, you know, his freshman year, even at the age of 15, he was already visiting regularly these extremely dodgy scam websites, particularly one called Talk Gold, which was run by the Krasenstein brothers, who became kind of these internet celebrities in the U.S. most recent in the last couple of years after Donald Trump won the White House. They became the sort of leaders of the online resistance. Of course, that was kind of scam in itself. But these were these websites, Tuckold and other websites like it, were these kind of Ponzi scheme clearinghouses where you could find schemes to invest in. Of course, they have other names, but they're essentially all Ponzi schemes, pyramid schemes. Find schemes to invest in. You can find people to help you run your own Ponzi schemes. Their strategies on how to invest in these high yield schemes and get out in time before, you know, the Ponzi takes all the money. So basically outsmart the Ponzis, and then tons of chat rooms about all of these subjects. And so he starts to get involved in this world at 15 and starts his own investment company business within a few months, SNS Investments, which, you know, the prospectus is hilarious. He talks about how he goes to great lengths to talk about how it's not a Ponzi scheme in his advertisement, basically, for the investment firm. So, I'm not going to tell you anything, but you will get these, you know, 150% profits within a week, and it's definitely not a Ponzi scheme. So it's essentially what you would imagine from a 15-year-old. And that was the first of a long series of schemes he ran that, you know, became a little bit more sophisticated, but not that much more sophisticated. And he advertised them in these forums, and it would always follow the same pattern, just about, which is, here's a great deal, invest your money with me, you'll get these enormous returns. And then at a certain point, some problem, something happens. Often there's a problem with a bank, which sort of prefigures what would actually happen with Quadriga and CIBC, where funds have been seized or some banking partner has put a block on funds. And then the returns start to, you know, he cuts off the returns, or people get smaller and smaller amounts or percentages of what they're owed. And excuse after excuse, you know, comes about until the investors finally give up all hope. It's a long process of attrition. But this is the familiar pattern for these online schemes. And then he starts a new one under a new name, and it all begins again. So he did that for years, all the way up until he's found, he begins Quadriga.
So he has no problem with nefarious business ideas.
Yeah, from stealing, just stealing from people, and, you know, total invention and yes, promising returns that he can't possibly back.
Did you speak to his wife?
She responded to a query of mine. I wrote her a letter when I was coming to Halifax to report the piece. And I think she hasn't responded to really any other reporters, at least not since the first, you know, few weeks after the death was reported. And she wrote me a very polite response that was mainly recommendation to enjoy, you know, the boats in the Halifax Harbor, something to that effect. It's a beautiful time of year. It was in June, I think. Beautiful time of year to see Halifax. But that she would not, she would not consent to an interview. Her lawyer, I was in touch with her lawyer after that for a few additional, you know, sort of fact-checking type questions.
He had a number of assets as well, or they had a number of assets, a number of properties, which also did make me laugh because they have a property in a place called Bedford. So I'm from Bedford in the UK, so that did make me laugh. But they, was it 12 million in real estate, cars, he's got the plane, the boat, which the story starts with. Has that all been taken away now? Is that,
So I should have said that's part of what Ernst & Young has been able to claw back. And of course, you know, $12 million in assets, but that number has depreciated considerably because, in part because, you know, the yacht and the airplane, the private airplane, have not been well maintained. And then also, you know, the assets, of course, are only worth what you can resell them for. And, you know, anyone trying to sell this property is now faced with, you know, the buyers will know that it's they have to get rid of it fast. And so, they're basically underpriced as a result. So I think that $12 million is now closer to $8 or $9 million. But that all of that, she, in a settlement, she has officially now turned over to the creditor class.
Did the Chihuahuas get their $100,000?
I don't believe so.
It did make me laugh. So what happens now? Like, what do you expect's going to happen now?
Well, there are at least four investigations by federal law enforcement agencies. FBI seems to be the most robust. RCMP seems to be much less serious. And there's at least two other countries that are investigating, and I've reason to believe one is Japan. And so these will run its course. So I think the best, you know, our best chance at getting to some kind of definitive answer is through the FBI investigation. And that is the most thorough. And so we may understand more about where the money went. You know, the reckless trading of the funds doesn't account for all of it. That we know of. It might be that he recklessly traded away, you know, 200 plus million, but I think we only know that he did so with something like 70 or 80 million of it. Okay. So it's almost definitely unrecoverable. It's hard to imagine that it's sitting somewhere at this point, or that any significant chunk of it is sitting somewhere. And then meanwhile, the creditors are waiting to get their, you know, they'll divide the money that Ernst & Young has been able to get back, something like 30 or 35 million will be.
So that's about what, like $1, $1.10 in every $10.
Right. It's something. Yeah, exactly. And so it's a little more than, 10% or 15, close to 15%, but it's not all 76,000 people who lost money, will have made a claim. And in fact, there's $70 million of it, it seems, belong to a single creditor. And I think there's a good chance, for instance, that creditor will not come forward and make a claim because, you know, you have to ask who is the person that put $70 million on this exchange. I think there's a pretty good chance some kind of a criminal entity.
Wow.
And so as we've seen in other... when other exchanges have gone bust for this reason, or, you know, Liberty Reserve went bust, a lot of the major creditors don't come forward because they don't want to show their faces to law enforcement. So It might be that if you're just an ordinary, you know, as you said, moron, you know, sorry, someone who put way too much money on Quadriga, you might actually get a higher percentage of it back because the group of creditors might be significantly smaller than the group of people who actually lost the money.
But that itself is fascinating, that there's somebody there who can write off 70 million or has to write off 70 million. Well, I mean, they're writing off 70 million as the loss, but I guess they're writing off 7 to 10 million in recoverable funds.
Right. I mean, but it gets back to one of your original questions is if Jerry had lost all this money and he knew who, you know, his major clients were, that was because of their lack of any controls. He was very, you know, he knew exactly who was investing huge amounts of money with him. Yes, you could imagine a situation where some drug cartel, say, has 70 million on the exchange and Jerry starts to worry he's not going to be able to pay them back. So yes, so the existence of this one whale, I think, gives you more reason to think that he was afraid not only for, you know, the exchange to collapse, but that someone was going to try to get revenge on him if they didn't get their money back.
Well, a $70 million whale who is potentially a drug cartel is a high incentive to disappear.
Yes, absolutely.
And I guess... See, you're swinging me back again. You're adding a few more percent into the disappearance theory because I try to put myself in the same shoes. Yeah, you're risking your life at that point.
Yeah, I mean, the most difficult thing to understand about what would seem to be the most plausible theory, which is that he fucked up and he lost some money. You know, not legitimately, it's not quite the right word, but he lost some money for non-nefarious reasons, or at least reasons that he couldn't control, and then tried to trade his way out of it, is that the dollar amounts don't fully add up. This was the biggest obstacle for me for the kind of, you know, the fuck up theory, which is that, okay, you lose $14 million in the Ether coding issue. You lose maybe another $5 million to a crooked third-party payment processor, and you lose maybe another $10 million to a different one. Okay, so now you're down, you know, $30 million out of 200 or 250 at that point. Do you really start making like Hail Mary trades on Zcash to recover that $30 million? You know, it doesn't quite make sense. So then you could say, okay, well, maybe the market, you know, based on the shift in the market, if you lose the 14 million in Ether and then Ether spikes, maybe that 14 million now is something closer to 40 or 50 million. You're getting closer, but it's still hard to imagine then squandering 150 million or whatever it is left. The scale doesn't quite add up to me. It has been explained to me that some of these bets that he was doing, these margin bets, are enormously high risk, and that you could, you know, risk losing a ton, and especially if you double down on it, that you could get there. You could get to the point of having a hole of, you know, beginning with a hole of $30 million and then ending with a hole of $200 million.
But other exchanges have lost money, and they've been quite open and honest with their customers, and usually come up with a plan either to socialize the loss or to have some kind of long-term recoverable program, whether it be some token or some share of profits. But that's the standard MO. But then this isn't a standard person operating, yeah, honestly.
Well, he was honest about the Ether loss, but
he said,
yeah, they that was made public. But he said it wouldn't have any, he said that Quadriga would absorb it from its profits. Fine. But yeah, so that's, but right. So then he maybe lost another 15 or so million on these other avenues. But yeah, it's not totally logical to me that even if you were starting to panic, that you would then risk so many more tens of millions of dollars on these other trades rather than look for an easier solution, as you said, to sort of socialize the loss in some way. And I'll add another wrinkle that I didn't write about in the piece, because it would have just taken, you know, gone into this other realm of speculation. But there is a lot of evidence to suggest that Jerry owned a significant amount of Ether, and that he got it early on, that he was either part of the pre-sale because he was working with he's working with Buterin at the Vitalik Buterin at the same, you know, workspace at Decentral in Toronto. And furthermore, there are chat logs that were leaked in which he talks about buying an additional large amount of Ether shortly after it went public. So some of these online sleuths have basically put together that he probably owned something like somewhere between $10 to $20 million in Ether is the suggestion. So you then also have to add that to the amount of money that he could have absorbed, you know? So say Quadriga is down $20 or $30 million. Well, if he's sitting on his own stash of $20 million, sure, he's not going to want to, you know, he'll do anything he can not to use his own funds to salvage his business. But at a certain point, if he's really fearful, you would think that that would be an escape hatch that he seems mm-hmm. never to have used. So that adds to the question of, you know, how plausible is it really that he did squander so much money, and or even that he felt the need to risk so much money?
Yes, yeah, it's so fascinating. Lastly, before we close out, what's happened with Michael Parkland? Is he talking? Is he under investigation?
Patron seems to be under investigation. He is. He told me as much. I've communicated with him for the piece. He wouldn't speak on the phone, but I communicated with him through Telegram, where he remains a very active participant of this public chat room, Quadriga Uncovered, that's mainly composed of creditors who've lost their money and are really upset about it, but also is visited from time to time by one of their lawyers. And also, I know is being monitored by journalists as well as law enforcement from at least FBI and RCMP. So it's this very strange virtual realm where not only the investigators and those being investigated, as well as the victims, all are in this ongoing conversation. And Patron is a regular there under the name Chad is his most recent moniker. And his general version of events, which he was, you know, which he speaks about in the chat room and as well as in private chats, has been that he was involved in a limited role with Quadriga up until 2016, when things really started to go off the rails. He left then after a dispute with Jerry over the decision to try to list the company on the public stock exchange, and had no insider involvement since then.
Right.
And that's essentially the line that he's towed. Of course, there's a lot of reasons to think he was, you know, much more heavily involved early on and founded it essentially, perhaps with Jerry as a frontman. Patron disputes that, but that was the more general perception. So he claims that, you know, he thinks that Jerry is dead. He thinks that his version of events, Jerry was operating it on the up and up until about 2016, when Patron left, and then he started to do all this Ponzi scheme stuff. But he wouldn't talk about his own involvement in any of, you know, his past operations, some of which were the subject of federal investigations in the U.S. and his own record. You know, he served time in federal penitentiary in the U.S. before being deported to Canada. So he essentially denies any claims and the version of against him that portray him in an unfavorable light, and continues to assert this narrative that exonerates him.
It's almost like these exchange operators need background checks.
Yeah, you would think. Yeah. Well, and in fact, of course, his identity was revealed during a background check that was conducted by a guy, Ryan Muller, who I interviewed for the piece, who worked for a third party payment processor, and it would seem the rare TPP that actually had a very serious kind of background check scrupulousness to it. And Quadriga had approached them about working together. And after Ryan did his own investigation of Patron and Patron's background, they declined to be involved with them.
I think the lesson from it all really is, going back to what Trace Mayer said, it's not your keys, not your Bitcoin. You really should not be trusting other people with your Bitcoin. You really should be holding your own private keys. I think that that's the kind of summary for me. What you know, as an outsider, you're not a Bitcoiner, you're a journalist, right? And you've come into this, and like, what's your kind of summary of the whole thing? What do you make of it all?
Well, I think it asks a larger question, which is to say that yes, I think certainly you shouldn't trust exchanges, but you know, the premise of cryptocurrency, of Bitcoin, is that you can be outside of these structures that we've set up in society that have all of these problems that we know of. Central banks, you know, the politics, government, law enforcement, all the rest. And I guess the question is, can you ever really be outside of it? There will be no more exchanges in a few years. Maybe the community will come to its senses about it and say, we can't have this loophole. It undermines the entire edifice. But then the question is, will there be some other kind of loophole that will come about to prey mm-hmm. on, you know, and a certain, you know, you have to be able to trade for the cryptocurrency, for the market to work. It seems to me, I mean, I would defer to you about this, but there has to be some way of facilitating the kind of easy trading that is done on these exchanges. And
you need price discovery.
Right. And you need there to be a way for people who aren't savvy about the technology to still use Bitcoin if you want it to expand and grow and to become more central to in society. And so I think the real question it raises, and I don't have the answer, but is the whole premise of Bitcoin that you can be outside, or of cryptocurrency, that you can be in this decentralized system, is that an illusion? Will there always be some loophole that will undermine this utopian ideal? And I don't know the answer from a technological or economic standpoint, but from a human standpoint, since I'm a writer and that's what I study, I would guess that yes, there will always be a vulnerability that could be exploited by people who want to. It might be a lot more difficult than, you know, building an exchange in the future, but I imagine that, you know, people will always find a way to screw it up.
Is there anything more in the story for you, or are you done with it, or is there anything more in Bitcoin for you? Are you going down a rabbit hole of other things you think you want to report on and write about?
I don't know. It feels a little too early to tell. I mean, I think this story certainly is still evolving, in that these investigations are ongoing. It may be that the findings are never made public. You know, if they don't find anything that leads to some kind of indictment, or you know, they don't discover more money, it might be that these investigations lead to a dead end. So I'll certainly be following what happens with that. But it's not like I want to investigate the next, you know, exchange that seems obviously to be a Ponzi scheme. And there do seem to be, I have found that there are a few that seem to be, you know, the next Quadrigas in the works right now. But no, I mean, I think I came to it not out of a desire to, you know, tell some story about cryptocurrency, but as to tell a story about, you know, how we put our, you know, where we decide to put our faith, and how, you know, this idea of, you know, as guarded as we can be, I think we still open ourselves up. We still have vulnerabilities that we can never fully defend against. And that's a story that I find interesting. And it's one that you can tell pretty well, I think, through Quadriga, but it's certainly not exclusive to the world of cryptocurrency.
Well, it's a fantastic article. I always find it interesting. It's in some ways more interesting when an outsider reports on something with industry, and it's not like a clickbait piece. You know, the articles you tend to get when the price is running up tend to be a little bit kind of crazy and all speculative and about crazy new money and people getting rich. And when it comes down, it seems to be declaring the death of Bitcoin, and they get a bit boring. But I found yours very interesting and engaging piece, because you came at it pretty objectively with an open mind, and it was really interesting. So congratulations on that. It's really good. I'm really thank you for coming on as well. I think people would be really interested in this, especially following my interview with Jamie Bartlett about OneCoin. I think people will be interested in this. So, yeah, I just want to say a big thank you. If people do want to follow your work, Nathaniel, how do they track what you're doing and read other things that you've worked on?
Yeah, I have a website, nathanielrich.com. I'm a novelist first, really. I have three novels, and my most recent book is a narrative nonfiction book called Losing Earth about early history of climate change politics. But yeah, I tend to write narrative work, fiction and nonfiction, and so this story was too good to pass up. And you know, I especially like stories where there is some kind of moral tension, and as you say, sort of inability to. Stories that resist clean resolutions, and so this fit the bill for me.
Well, fantastic. Well, listen, look, thanks for coming on. Wish you all the best in the future. Hopefully one day I'll get down to New Orleans, we can hang out and have a beer. And if you need anything from me, if you do dip in the Bitcoin world again, if you've got any questions, you know you can reach out to me.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm certainly more tentative than I even was now after reporting this piece, but I will be following closely, and I appreciate your having me on to your program.
No problem. Take care.
Take care.
All right. So what did you make of that? Did you enjoy that one? I found this one really fascinating, actually. I learned so much more about it than before I'd done the interview. I'd heard the Quadriga story, and I'd heard some of the rumors, but doing the deep dive, yeah, what a weird and crazy story. And, you know, you can't help but find the circumstances around Gerald's death to be hugely suspicious. You know, I originally thought this had all the hallmarks of an exit scam, but since I've learned the more kind of nuances of the story and the intricacies of what happened with Gerald before he disappeared, you know, I really can't put my finger on exactly what's happened. I've got my suspicions. I mean, perhaps he did just die, but I don't know. A weird and fascinating story either way. And I think also it's a nice follow-up from my interview with Jamie Bartlett, where we looked at the OneCoin scam. And I know they're slightly different topics, but there's also some similarities in the story. So if you haven't heard that one, you might want to check that one out as well. I think it's quite fascinating to look at some of these scams that have happened in the world of Bitcoin and crypto. Anyway, look, I hope you enjoyed it. If you do have any questions or do have any feedback, you can hit me up. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Also, as ever, thank you to everyone who supports the show. Whatever you've done, you know, I'm amazed with all the support I've had this year. If you do want to support the show, though, there's so many things you can do. Like a review on iTunes is helpful. Being a sponsor is helpful. Just sharing the show out with your friends and family is helpful as well. But if you're a regular listener and you think, damn, Pete, I want to help you, I want to do something, please do go and check out my website. It's whatbitcoindid.com. It'll explain everything you can do there. There's a support section. Just click on that. And as I said, I'm out in Bolivia. I'm working on a story for Defiance regarding Evo Morales and the recent controversial fourth term election he had. And actually, he's now in Argentina in exile. So I've been finding out what's going on here. So I'm looking forward to get that out, trying to get to the truth, because I haven't been able to find an exact version of events from typical online sources. After that, I'm hoping to head to El Salvador. I've got a couple of leads for some interesting stories there. Then I'll be into the States before I head home for Christmas. Again, it's been an amazing year. I love you all. Thank you for everyone who's helped me get to where I am with both of these podcasts. Any questions, you can hit me up. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.